going to be used.
This is John England. I'm here with, go ahead and please say your name.
Cindy Gentry.
And today's date is July 17th.
Might be the 19th.
July 19th, 2016. And we're here in downtown Phoenix discussing the Dinner 2040 project. So Cindy, if you could tell me a little bit about your early years, where you were born and when, if you feel comfortable with that.
Oh, I was born in Chicago, Illinois in 1951 and grew up in and around the city in the northern suburbs of Skokie. And when I was a sophomore in high school, my parents moved to Glencoe. And then I went downstate to school to Champaign-Urbana.
Oh, okay. Great. Tell me a little bit about your schooling and education.
I was 12 when the civil rights movement happened, and we lived in kind of a ghetto. About 40% of the people that came from Germany and Eastern Europe that survived the camps came to Skokie, and yet it was still mostly Jewish enclave. And so when the first African-American families moved in, everybody was up in arms. And I remember the shift in the community, and my parents going to welcome a couple of these families, but unfortunately some of their neighbors had thrown rocks through their windows and done some other unwelcoming things. And so there was that kind of pretty normal middle-class life, and then the chance to really start looking at injustice and inequity in that way.
Yeah. So you had sort of a civil or so your education, a lot of it took place outside of the school atmospheres.
Well, some of the more memorable, I had to go to school, and I had younger brothers, and we all had to do all the things that you're supposed to. My parents were active in the PTA and volunteered in the community and did homework, and I was the only, although oldest, girl, and my brothers were smarter than me and skipped and did grades and stuff and were good in math. I was not. I was good in reading and the soft sciences.
Right. Okay. What about your college education? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. What your college years were like?
Again, I went downstate to the University of Illinois right about the time that the Vietnam War was heating up.
Oh, and, wow.
In this case, my education was a lot more out of the classroom than in it. And I spent, it was in an engineering school. There was a lot of scientific stuff going on. There was a lot of war machine stuff going on, and the chance to understand that the next generation of people didn't really want to carry that on and let our voices be heard. So I spent 17 years getting my bachelor's degree in sociology. I stopped and finally finished up here at ASU.
Okay. So you were involved in a lot of
You
were involved
protests.
Politically and in the community. Wow,
yeah,
that's exciting. Yeah. So, where do you think food plays into that? Maybe you could talk about one or some of your most fond food memories.
I came from a loud, noisy Jewish family, and food was the center of everything. And that's how the dinners, the exchanges of ideas, the hearing of politics, the friendly and unfriendly arguments, the really bad jokes, everything kind of centered around normal dinner and then celebration dinners, and food was a big part of how we knew who we were.
Okay. Yeah. So did you have a lot of family, like beyond just your immediate family, like cousins, aunts and uncles?
Nobody was really scattered in those days. And these mm-hmm. days, everybody's an airplane ride or two away. But my dad's friends that he hung out with were from the neighborhood where he grew up. And he had a pretty good extended family. And my mom had, she's a little more independent, but she was still kind of not very far away from her parents, and so we grew up with cousins and aunts and uncles, and it's different today, I think.
Yeah. Great. So during these formative years, and while you're getting your education, were you involved in any sustainable organization or anything to do with the environment?
I don't think so. I think it had more to do with social justice. I think we were shown and taught and asked to volunteer to help people who had less access to what they needed than we did. I lived in a city, and then I lived in a suburb where my dad gardened. But it was, and then, it wasn't really about the environment at that time or knowing where your food came from, at least in our household. I became a vegetarian when I was about 15 and shocked the heck out of everybody. And, and at that time, joined Food First, which was just coming into being. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Frances Moore-LaPay. Now her daughter, Anna, has taken over. But at that time, they were starting to talk about eating lower on the food chain so that more people could get what they needed and learn that you could get my parents didn't believe this, but you could get just as much protein from eating rice and beans and cheese as you could from meat. My father was first-generation American, and so the thing that you'd wanted to make sure as a good provider was that you had meat on the table and potatoes and all that and vegetable. But then not too long after that, it became clear that we were consuming a lot of resources by having that model.
Okay. So maybe talk a little bit more about why and you made the switch to vegetarianism. What prompted that?
I got a hold of some reading material, and it was probably not Food First, but it could have been Mother Earth News. It could have been anything. It could have been a recipe book. Diet for a Small Planet was big then, and it was sort of like, wow. And I really didn't care for big heavy meat meals or anything. I mean, I liked it, but it was just easy. Nobody else followed suit, and I was the cook in the house, and so I still cooked whatever everybody else liked to eat, but I didn't eat the meat part.
Okay. Was that more of a dietary choice, or was it sort of a social justice choice, or...
Yeah, it had to do with understanding that there are way too many people starving, and we were consuming in our country way more than our share of the natural resources available, and part of that had to do with what it took to produce meat. And it seemed like maybe we could do more with less.
Okay. Is that sort of what started you on the path towards becoming interested in food sustainability or sustainable food systems?
No, I think just noticing from being a little kid that some people lived pretty rough, and just understanding that it was important to try to figure out how to change that.
Okay, great. So you're very cognizant at a young age of social welfare.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So what did, what was the catalyst that got you interested in sustainable food systems?
When I was, I already had moved out here, and I was trying to find a job in sustainable food systems, and the only job I could find was with the Food Bank Association. And it turned out to be a wonderful thing to have happen, but there wasn't an ASU School of Sustainability. There wasn't a chapter of Food First here. There wasn't Local First. There wasn't anything that I could find, and I looked pretty hard. There weren't even farmers markets in 1977, 78, 80. I graduated ASU in 86, and so I guess there weren't even farmers markets here. And so the idea of, well, what could I do to begin to help people who needed to access food do that better? So I was lucky I got a good job with the Association of Arizona Food Banks. But I came in there... the director is still a dear friend and was my mentor, and some, as were some of the other people there. But I came in there with the idea of we're doing heroic efforts to get people through the next 3 to 5 days, but where's the space for what got them in that fix in the beginning? And some of the food banks were more open to addressing that than others. There's a great model in Tucson, Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona, that in addition to their emergency network, they call it, it's a line from Feeding America, which is a national food relief organization. It's called Feed the Line and Shorten the Line. And so they're working very strongly on Shorten the Line. And then somewhere in there, my job turned to get out into with the statewide gleaning project to go out into the fields and help recover what would have been disked under or just thrown away, or go to the coolers down in Casa Grande, Eloy, Nogales, Yuma, all that, and help that project rescue food and get it on the tables of hungry people. And one morning, just about first light, I was standing out in the West Valley talking to a guy, and I said, oh, thank you for your donation. And he plants extra to feed the food banks. He said, don't thank me. I'm not making enough to take the tax credit.
Oh, wow.
And I'm just thinking, all right, there's all this food out here. There are all these people hungry. And that guy's not even making a living farming. He is now. But the idea is that it is less about lack of food than it is about distribution and access. And a light bulb just switched on like that. If the producers aren't making a living and there's all this food and we can't get it to where it needs to get to, we need to do some shifts. And so I... spent a couple more years doing that program and then started my own organization called Community Food Connections. And the idea was to, and still is, to increase food access for vulnerable children and adults at the same time as building economic and community development for everybody, including keeping farmers on the land.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's so you mentioned that when you came here, there were no farmers markets. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Were you involved in farmers markets before you came here to Arizona?
No, but I had seen them around the country. I had the good privilege of traveling to California, to the Northwest, to the East Coast, and I had seen them. And let's see, 1991, I think the first market started here. Dee Logan started the first market with her husband. And I think it was at Heritage Square. And shortly thereafter, Roadrunner at 36th Street and Cactus, and then Mesa. So she's been doing it for a long time. But before that, I didn't find any. I didn't know about it. I like markets. My grandfather didn't finish seventh grade. He came to this country, baby. He had to stop it when he was 12 and help support his family. And I was at some point rebellious and thinking of dropping out of high school. And he took me in his Cadillac down to the Maxwell Street Market, which is on the west side of Chicago, and it's this wholesale market. Half the mob has families there. It was quite a colorful place. And he said, if you don't finish high school, you're going to end up down here. And irony was that, you know, how many years later, 35, 25 years later, I did end up starting a market here and getting involved in supporting the whole market system in our state with some federal programs. And so he was gone by then. He died when I was 18, but it has not stopped me chuckling from time to time.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about starting the Community Food Connections?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, it had to do with talking to that grower and just saying, okay, the Food Bank Network is heroic. The Gleaning Project is doing some amazing things. But I really, by that time, the Community Food Security Coalition had come about in 1996, and I was part of that. and I was just getting an itch to go focus on some other aspects of food access. And in 2002, I retired from the Food Bank Association and started that organization.
Oh, okay.
And we focused on a food policy council. I had contracts from different, and farm to school. I had contracts from different friends here and in New Mexico and nationally that kept me afloat until we got the proper paperwork in place, the 501c3, and then brought in with friends programs like the Farmers Market Nutrition Program and SNAP at the Markets, food stamps is what it was called, and got some equipment going for them, and so that different markets around the state could begin to process food stamps, and a federal program called Farmers Market Nutrition Program, which is for low-income moms and kids on WIC and for seniors. We got the first part of that going, a bunch of us, and then got the idea that I should start a public market as kind of a central place for not only the market, you know, building it up to be a 7-day-a-week market, have it be like have storage and be like a food hub where food could be aggregated, food could be distributed. It would be a place for local food. And we were on our way to that, and I ran into, when you're a nonprofit, who's really in charge is the board of directors. Mm-hmm. And we had a differing of opinion in 2012 and went our different ways.
Okay.
But the Downtown Phoenix Public Market is is where that started, and it was meant to expand into a community kitchen and to have, you know, pickup spaces for schools, and chefs do come there now.
Oh, wow.
Still, but it was meant to be a lot more organized around being a hub for local food.
Okay. Wow. So you mentioned a little bit of opposition. What kind of opposition, or maybe you could just talk about the kinds of opposition that you've encountered in setting up these organizations.
Well, my brother is an anthropologist, and he decided to go off on his own somewhere back in the early 2000s, and he set up an LLC, and I said, why didn't you make it a nonprofit, because then you can write for grants and do all that. And he said, because I want to do what I want to do, and I don't want to have to worry about a board trying to direct me or govern me. And I said, oh, that'll never happen. I've worked for nonprofits for my whole, most of my adult career. And so another buddy of mine said, well, just pick who you want, who you trust with your life to be on your board. And I said, okay, that makes sense. But those people got tired after a few years, or they moved away or something, and then other people came in, and they had a different idea of community service. They had a different, they were, got burned out. Some of them thought, like, there was a little power thing, like they thought I was trying to do things for my own behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Where I wasn't, I was just trying to share my experience, and so that can happen. Money,
right.
Troubles can happen, and at the end of the day, they said, "Well, it's going to be this way or no way."
Wow!
And I didn't pop them in the nose as I should have done, probably, or fire them or whatever. There were only a few left by that time. And so that organization and I was not strong enough to move on forward.
Right. And in making healthy food more accessible to lower-income families, like incorporating SNAPs into farmers markets and that sort of thing, did you encounter any opposition with that?
No. At the same time that you're bringing access to people, you're bringing income to growers. You know, at first,
right.
I'd hear these little comments from the farmers, and they'd be like, oh, they drive a better car than I do, and all this kind of thing. And all right, maybe they have that car today. Maybe it's not even theirs. Maybe they borrowed it. And next time you see them, they might not have it. And then they started thinking about their sister-in-law who was on WIC, or their other family circumstances that might have led somebody to be compromised in a little way. And pretty soon it was like the most annoying thing was, well, people forget there's a certain, for part of the program of Farmers Market Nutrition Program, there's a window from March to the end of October, and a lot of people just swamp at the end of October, and our produce season is kind of lean at that time here in the valley.
Okay.
So they would gripe about that, but at the end of the day, it became like a little social experiment. Markets can help bring people together who not normally wouldn't be in the same place.
Excellent. So that leads into another question, which is, how do you build bridges between other activists and organizations with the goal of making food more accessible?
I think that's the crux of the matter. How do you make it normal for people to come and use their food benefits at markets and have access? Do you bring the food to the neighborhoods? Do you make transportation arrangements? But you have to find people in the neighborhood that people, other people look up to, that are willing to kind of lead the charge. And it's like, well, if Grandma Nelson says this, then we're going to do it.
Right.
Because it isn't normal right now. People were using bribery, incentive items. If you use your EBT, they call it, or the Farmers Market Nutrition Program coupons, you'll get a gift at certain markets, which this office now provides. A nonprofit here called Pinnacle Prevention just got a federal grant. It's called Food Insecurity Nutrition Incentive Program, and it will match up to $10 a purchase with somebody using their SNAP card at specific markets and CSAs. It's just starting. There's funding for some of it in Tucson right now through a different source, and the International Rescue Committee has a market that I work with that already has matching dollars through the same federal grant.
Oh, wow.
So we're trying to, in other parts of the country, it's been wildly successful. And I saw it this morning, I was at the market. You use $10 of SNAP or FMNP, and you get $10 of food free.
Wow.
So you stretch your food dollars enormously.
Right.
So not to skirt the question, it's really tricky and it's really slow, and you have to go where people are and they have to come to trust you. I do two markets. I work with two groups that do markets at WIC offices in low-income neighborhoods, and it takes a minimum of a year for people to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
And just think you're not trying to give them bad produce, or you're not trying to, there's still this, the prices are too high at farmers markets. It's only for white middle class, chic people, whatever.
Right.
So there's a lot of perceptions to overcome, and you know, the verdict is still kind of out for me about whether, like, I'd like to try a mobile market like Fresh Express, but just do local food on it.
Uh-huh.
And see if people would respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if they will.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, some good ideas. What about... have you tried to incorporate different, or rather, are there other agencies that are more localized here, sort of organizations or groups that you've tried to incorporate into making food more accessible?
I personally work with three right now at the various markets, and then they work with and expands out.
Oh, okay.
And I think that having them involved helps. You need to have people that look like you. If you're in a Spanish-speaking neighborhood, you need to be able to speak to the people. People need to feel comfortable.
Right. Great. So this is a very broad question. You can answer it however you want. But how do you think this is important for the future of food?
I think that everybody deserves to have access to healthy food, and most people want to eat healthy and provide healthy food for their children. I've heard older ladies like look at the market table and, oh, where's the meat and potatoes? I'll come back when, you know, and it's supposed to be a giggle. They're just come out, they've had their blood pressure, you know. So, but I think that it has to become normal and available so that people can change their habits. Everybody didn't always drink Pepsi-Cola. Everybody didn't always go to Starbucks, for goodness sake. And it's sort of some kind of, you can't avoid it. It's everywhere. It's in the convenience stores. It's in the liquor stores, whatever. That's where some people buy their food in some neighborhoods. And by food, we're talking loosely here, but Slim Jims and whatever.
Sure.
But it's got, there's got to be a shift where people taste, they remember, they know how to basically cook. I was making up, printing out recipes when you came. Uh-huh. What do you do with this stuff? Mm-hmm. I could do that.
Yeah.
It's easy. And I think that if we want people making healthy food choices, there's a crazy amount. 68% of our population here in Arizona is overweight, and some minor, you know, smaller, but not much smaller portion of that wanders into the range of obesity. In 2006, and I realize that's 10 years ago, but it's a study done by the Department of Health Services, half of the deaths in our state had to do with nutrition-related disease.
Wow.
They could have been mitigated by access to better food. So if you're thinking about public health, and if you're thinking about lower insurance costs for everybody, and you're thinking about a cleaner environment that's less taxing on whatever contributes to climate change, we should be making it more possible for people to have healthier food choices. Not just fruits and vegetables, but fruits and vegetables, clean, antibiotic-free meat, because it's been proven that if you eat meat, that animals that have been treated with antibiotics to make them grow faster and keep healthy in a herd, that your body becomes resistant to the antibiotics.
Oh, wow.
Hormone-free, because there are studies showing that little children, women, girls that have hormones in their milk are starting their menstrual cycles earlier.
Wow.
Pesticide-free, because who knows what the heck is going on with the things that kill pesticides. And so all of those things are all connected, and here, you know, I am only been here, I'll be here 2 years next weekish.
Oh, wow.
August 4th. People have weird ideas. They think that if you're low income, you shouldn't be buying organic food. They think it's enough to eat vegetables rather than buy local. And I'm like, this is crazy. You could do two things at one time. You could buy local food, you could spend the same amount of money and keep the money here in the community, and you know where your food comes from. You're making a choice about, it tastes better, it's picked the day before, you know, and so you want to have more of it. It should be in our school meals all the time.
Yeah.
And our school gardens, it's now possible for people to, kids to eat what they grow in their meals, so that you're surrounded by healthy choices, and it's not just like food is like this thing that comes out, you know, it's over processed, it comes out of a bag, you never feel quite full,
right.
But you feel well salted and and all that, and so it, I like ice cream and chips the most, as, you know, the next guy, but it's, I have a choice to get those. I don't eat too much processed food except pasta, because I don't know how to, I haven't sat down to make it by myself, and I buy bread from the store, but the rest of it, rice, I guess we buy rice and bulk beans, but people should have the choice of it, and it should be close to them, and they shouldn't have to worry that if they try something new for their kid and the kid throws it away, they've just put money down the drain that they can't replace.
Sure.
That kind of thing. So that's how I think local connects to making your economy better, making your community more connected, making the environment cleaner, and addressing health-related disease, nutrition-related disease.
Great, thank you. Yeah, it seems very important then, just all these connections. So you've talked a lot about working with other people and organizations, and you even spoke about a board of directors. Now, when you're working with all those people, how do you decide, how do you create a sort of list of priorities, or which food problems do you decide to address first?
Well, I think you have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I just had somebody said review this policy for the Maricopa County Food System Coalition, and they were going to be advocates for local food policies. I said, well, how do you know which ones? you know, they asked me to comment, and I said, sounds good. How do you know which ones? You're going to have a slew of them.
Right.
And so you have to sit down and figure out broad categories, and then the low-hanging fruit, what can be done here and what can be done here. So there's some strategic planning involved in it.
Sure.
I was working with a group in South Phoenix that they're all over the place. Their vision, their charisma is just fabulous, but it's like I can't keep up with what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And I told them to call me when they're ready to do a couple of things. And
yeah.
I'm working with another group of farmers right now, and we're going to focus on a couple of things that we agreed to are the most. Everybody talks and everybody says, well, this is where I'm coming from. This is what's important to me. Oh, this is where I'm coming from. It's a little bit different. Let's figure it out.
Right.
So it's just a process.
Mm-hmm. Great. So we've talked about this a little bit, but what do you think are the biggest challenges to creating a sustainable food system?
Land ownership, water access. Most of the growers I know don't own the land they farm on. Water is a big issue. There's some tension between use of water for municipal, you know, housing developments and farming and zoning for ag land is, you know, putting some kind of land into agricultural production for a long time, preservation. So land and water are big, zoning's big. Where's the next generation of growers going to come from? It's hard. Farming's hard.
Right.
It hurts. It hurts your body. It hurts your mind. It hurts your pocketbook. And yet some people can't be anything but growers and ranchers. And so the next generation of growers. And then getting it to be in demand. At people wanting it, knowing it. It's like you go to Burlington, Vermont, and you can't escape it. You walk down the street, and everybody's got a blackboard in the window, what's on the menu and where, what farm it came from.
Oh, wow.
I was just in Madison, Wisconsin. It's the same, at least where I was. They really highlighted it. Here, it's not so much. And then the fourth or fifth piece is policy. It is policy that state and national policy that encourages local food distribution, access, consumption, and production.
Right. Okay. So with that in mind, I guess, what does food sustainability mean to you?
Well, those pieces that need to be in place.
Okay.
You'd need to have production capacity, you'd need to have distribution capacity, and then you need to have demand, access, consumption preferability. So it's just of a piece. It has to be able to be available, and then it has to be able to be accessible, and then people have to want it, and it just keeps going around like that. The more people want it, the more people are going to try to make sure that it happens.
Great. What is Dinner 2040?
It seems to be a cultural event that shows us where we are and where we could be, and involves, because of the people planning it, local historical context as well as some kinds of real tangible art forms. I know that the plates and the serving and all the utensils and stuff Joan Baron has been integral in putting together, and so you're going to get an experience of where we could be and where we hope to be as a community 24 years from now or whatever it is. And and I am not sure then what we have to do to ensure that we get there. But I hope we figure that part out.
Great. So why do you think the Dinner 2040 program is important to the community?
Well, because it brings a focus home on where we might not be if we don't pay attention, for one thing. I know that there's some tribal folks that have been invited to be involved, and I hope that it shows the kind of broad spectrum of people involved in the food system, and people are just going to have to step up and say if they care enough to say what could happen in 2040 if we don't pay attention. Where's our food going to come from? What's it going to look like? What's going to happen to our farmers, average age 61 here in our state, if we don't do something now to protect them? So I think for that reason, if they lift that up, I think that part is important.
Okay, great. And what do you consider your role to be in the Dinner 2040 program?
At this point, I've just said I'm going to be a volunteer. I have been a gadfly. I have been an idea expander. I have been a person pointer, include this person, how about that person, how about that person. Somehow they have managed to pull it together, but I got impatient with the planning process, and I stepped back, and both the Jones know that, and Maya. I've put on many a conference in my life, and I need a little more structure. They've got it. It looks beautiful. And at this point, I said, do with me what you will on the day of. and I'll wash dishes or whatever you got there.
Sure.
Set up tables. But that's how it was. I love talking with both. It's been Joan and Maya and me for the most part. I haven't met most of the students. And And so we've just been going, oh, no, what? You know, we've just done a lot of back forth and sure. Visioning, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there, and then I just kind of said, you guys, I need this. I need, here's a list of things I need in order for me to understand how we're actually going to pull this off.
Yeah.
And they've done it. From what I can tell from reading the emails, it looks like they've. You know, I made a grid, and that's how my brain works. And I was like, "Where's the timeline? How are you going to account for this? How do you do that?" And it looks like they've made a. You know, in a parallel universe, a way to make the event happen. So,
great,
so good. Yeah.
So how did you find out about it, or were introduced to it?
Oh, I think John Barron invited me. I knew her from the market downtown, and I knew Maya. Maya's like one of my best friends, Maya Daly, and. I didn't know Joan, but it turns out I know her daughter.
Oh.
And she had a food truck before she went to work with her stepdad, and she made the best food ever. And I didn't know they were connected.
Oh, okay.
And I have just been around in the world of local food for a day or two. So.
Right. What were your first thoughts about the idea of sort of creating a vision for what the Arizona food system would look like in 25 years or so?
Well, I think it's good to start with where we're at now and get a baseline and then try to figure out what needs to happen. And I think there was an event at ASU for a couple of days, several years ago already now, where when they first got this grant, they brought in Vandana Shiva from India to come, and then they had people from all over the country that were also participating in this project in their own communities. And so we sat for 2 days in what used to be the sociology building over there at ASU, and kind of went through the fast track of what will it look like, what would a dinner look like, what is important to you, even down to what the menu would be, and everybody had, you know, they do that, they split you up and all that. And so I thought it was worthwhile because there were some pretty out of the box thinkers at the table, and that was kind of fun. And then all of a sudden it was like, okay, well, now we're going to plan a dinner here. I'm like, okay. And we've moved the date twice because it wasn't quite gelled yet.
Right.
Hmm.
Okay. So there's the dinner 2040 is sort of centered around the humanities, right? And usually when people think about food sustainability, it's very scientific, right? Mm-hmm. Or engineering and all that. Could you talk a little bit about what the humanities have to offer as far as food sustainability goes?
The little I know about it is that our relationships to each other and to the world and to material things and immaterial things, our religion, are a lot of times based in history and religion and worldview. Mm-hmm. And so the more clear we can become about what worldviews are in play as we understand who has access to food and how it's produced, the stories, the traditions, the more familiar we can become with options. It's like being a world traveler. Mm-hmm. If you just stay in your neighborhood and you just do what you do, it's one thing, you can honor and revere that, but the minute you step out and you visit Scandinavia or Ireland or West Africa, and all of a sudden people are thinking about things and doing them differently, then you begin to say, well, gosh, I wonder how that can apply here. Mm. So I think it's about expanding your cultural base, and I think it's about recognizing where you've come to on the continuum from whatever religious forces and revolutionary forces and everything got us to this day. Mm. I personally think we're coming out of this, but in the last 400 to 600 years in the United States, the prevailing point of view that people seem to being adhere to is that the more stuff you have, the better person you are.
Hmm.
And those without are pretty shameful examples of human beings. And I think that has its roots in certain kinds of religions and organized religions. And I think that the idea of man, humans being dominant over nature and all that kind of stuff have led us to the huge amounts of disparity that we see. And so
mm-hmm.
I think that being able to get some context for that and understand it doesn't always have to be like that going into the future is maybe where the humanities come in.
Yeah, when you talk about sort of the cultural expectations that are associated with food, it made me think about what you said about your father, how being a good provider meant that you were able to put meat on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very interesting. Is there anything left that you'd like to add about mm-hmm. Dinner 2040 or food sustainability in general?
No, I think in this fast-paced world we live in, though, John, I just think sharing a meal with friends and remembering to share it with others less fortunate is a huge gift.
Great. Thank you.